OK, vous êtes tous assiégés. Très bien, on pourrait commencer avec notre deuxième panneau. Et cette fois, on va discuter les illusions et les réalités économiques auxquelles notre pays fait face. I'm going to take Gordon's example and say a few words. I wasn't going to, but precedent is precedent. To me, there are three points that are worth making. One is that we had one illusion, which we're trading for another. That is to say, we believed that we were safe in our dependence on the United States, that that was a guaranteed form of prosperity and security. We now believe that we must assert our independence or we will not survive. So these are two very powerful illusions that need to be tested against. Indeed, the first has been tested against reality. The second illusion I think that is worth noting is that perhaps I'm not speaking for all Canadians, but those making public discourse tended to look down on rocks and logs and oil and wheat. And yet, in reality, these are our strengths. These are the strengths, the only strengths we have, by the way, on which we have much possibility of building. So perhaps that reality has come to be recognized by the current government. The third point I'd like to make goes back to the last panel. I had occasion to work outside of government as well as in PCO. And I learned one thing. Which is that the isolation of the public service is extremely dangerous. Because we have come to believe, perhaps I'm projecting my own prejudices, that making policy is enough. And we know well enough what policy should do and what the policy should achieve that really everybody else should just follow. The fact is, there's a huge gulf between people making policy and real people working in the real world. So with those brilliant pieces of wisdom, let me introduce our panel. I think we're nous sommes très privilégiés d'avoir trois intervenants qui sont impliqués dans l'économie internationale, qui connaissent très bien le domaine et qui sont avec nous aujourd'hui. Drew Fagan probably needs no introduction to anybody who's used to read the Globe and Mail in the old days, and he has done many, many other interesting things since, been at the heart of many big issues, both at the federal and the provincial level. Natalie is a seasoned diplomat, one of our brightest economic thinkers. I'll say that. I believe it. And Patrick, of course, is one of our Canada's leading academic experts on international trade and business. So I think we'll have as interesting a panel looking at our economic problems and issues and possibilities as we did on the defense issues. They are, of course, interlinked and inseparable. So I think this second conversation may well follow organically on the first. With that, Drew.
Thanks, George. Okay. So first, I just want to start off. I just turned to Natalie and said, George is stealing our stuff. But we're going to touch on this. And your final point, actually, well, first, I want to make a couple of comments on just what you finished with, which was really interesting at the end of the first panel, which is the porousness or lack of porousness between government and the private sector and academia and things like that. Because I went in to DFAT and it was a wonderful experience. And then to, as a deputy at Queen's Park, mid-career. And, it's important now to think about this in the context of what this government has done in bringing in a few people from outside. And somebody actually called me as this was they were thinking about this and said, could you talk about your own experience and stuff like that? And I sent them a report. And here's a name, Arthur Kruger, did a report on the success of people going into the public service mid-career at senior levels. And I was shown this report 6 months after I arrived at DFATE, and it says that most people fail, which was helpful at the time, scared the hell out of me. And it's still around. You, I found it. I thought I had it. I found it on the internet. And why do they fail? These are very capable people, we all know, but it's a strong and complex culture. And there is something to the fact that the federal public service is in Ottawa and it's hard to break in. I didn't find it such. But there's complexity around it. I'm not going to get into that at length. Second thing I want to say is I'm at the Monk School. I'm the only professor at the Monk School who's not a career academic with the title professor. Okay, so we have all sorts of sessionals, friends from Queen's Park. You taught for a number of years. Rob Fonberg taught for a number of years. Yaprak did for a couple of years. But in terms of longevity and certainty, I'm the only one. Now, I spent last year, lucky enough to spend the year at Yale. Jackson School there is just in its sixth year, Master's of Public Policy, a global affairs program, very much like Monk, but smaller. Half of theirs come from Washington. So where that balance is in terms of teaching students and the Master's of Public Policy and the Master's of Global Affairs at Monk, they're thinking professional careers, not just in government, around government, in the private sector, in consulting, maybe at think tanks. A bunch of them go political to start off with. I could rhyme them off at Pearson in various ministers' offices as well as at Queen's Park. So that balance is important too, right? And how you think about that, it's important to have academics, career academics, teaching stuff I don't understand like R, but it's also important to have the other side too. Okay, so then I'm going to connect to the end of the conversation with a couple of comments. And one was from Jonathan with regard to interconnectedness. One was from Thomas with regard to, the comments about the United States. And here's my reality, and it sort of echoes Thomas a little bit, but I'm not going to overstate it because I know it's a little controversial. Geography still matters in terms of our continental ties. The CUSMA negotiations, I've been following them fairly closely, and there's a sensibility that we are playing defense, but that it's also fundamental. And you watch the prime minister's messaging on this, Davos, but also New York. And a lot of people, his speech in New York in some ways is as important as his speech in Davos. And you may like one more than the other, but his speech in New York was more of an integration speech, and his Davos speech was about breaking out of the force field with regard to the United States where it is now. I'm going to give a few statistics just to start and try not to go on too long. The Canadian economy is about $2.2 trillion. So 3/8 of that is represented by exports and imports from the United States. I'm being very rough here. About 1/3 of that, 1/8, is trade with the rest of the world. Half of it is with regard to the domestic economy, truly. I know it's a little fudgy. You're not going to move away from that. And that's the fundamental point with regard to the illusion that some people are talking about, and it's all in the word. We are going to pivot away from the United States. We are going to move away from the United States. So from the United States. We're not. And it's not the government's intention to do that. And read the New York speech underlines it. That's not his intention. And that's certainly not the intention with regard to the negotiators. We may be playing defense in a complicated environment, particularly political with what's going on in Washington, but we may end up with an agreement with the United States that actually includes less integration in some ways and more integration in others. And if there's going to be a sector in which there's more integration, I think it's going to be critical minerals as well as possibly energy. And critical minerals may be to this deal what energy was in the free trade agreement in the 1980s. So it's a change rather in terms of the relationship as opposed to a pivot away from it. The other illusion I want to mention is, and it's the prime minister who used this term himself, a rupture. Whether that was with the United States is what he meant, but or globally, there's been a lot of talk about a rupture with the United States. And in many ways, we can all feel that. I spent the last year in as I say, down in the States. It's a blue state. Everybody asked me what it was like. Well, you know, like I read the news like you guys do. But the rupture has actually been, and you know the statistics, a long process of already limiting or the relationship being more limited with the United States in terms of impact than it was, you know, it didn't happen in 2025. If there was a rupture, if you look at the statistics, it actually happened in 2001. We were much more dependent on the United States statistically in terms of trade, not just the percentage of trade. You always hear about 70, 75% of our trade is with the United States. Now it's a little bit less. It peaked in 2000 at 88% and on a much bigger share of GDP. Now I said it was about 3/8. Then it was over half. Our relationship, our economic relationship with the United States made up more than half of our GDP. It's actually gone down. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing depends on the circumstances that you're in. So reality, geography still matters. Illusion, that we're moving away now. We're trying to play defense and offense at the same time. Defense is with the United States. Offense is with regard to other parts of the world. And if Jonathan Miller mentioned in the past, in the previous session, we're not really choosing Europe, Asia. There's lots of opportunity there. Thank you.
Okay, just checking if this works. Excellent. So I'm going to preach a little bit from my parish, or what used to be my parish, which is Europe. And as we were discussing with Drew, obviously Europe cannot replace the U.S. as Canada's main market. Geographically speaking and gravity speaking, it just is what it is. But we are able to see Europe as a good complement, a strategic complement, and a way to diversify our market, our investment, and strengthen our supply chains. And that does give us a little bit more room to maneuver and then speak to the United States from a position of more power. L'opportunité européenne est bien réelle, mais seulement si nous allons au-delà de nos illusions réconfortantes et agissons en fonction des réalités pratiques que nous offre l'Europe. The first illusion I'll talk about is that, you know, when we've talked about it, that Europe can simply replace the U.S., just not possible. If we look at our supply chains, I mean, obviously the auto sector is a great example of that. You cannot unpick that supply chain is just impossible, and it is a big part of our economy, particularly in Ontario. And the energy security that we were talking about and the fact that perhaps Canada and the U.S. need to look at that relationship in terms of energy security for both sides. In 2024, Canada provided 70% of the volume of hydrocarbons and 81% of the electrical energy imported by the U.S., that is a lot. And so Mr. Trump can say all he wants in terms of we don't need anything from Canada, but if tomorrow morning all of that stopped, a lot of the industrial base of the U.S., particularly in the Northeast, but across the border, would suffer greatly. Europe is our second trading partner, the second largest economy when you look at them together after the U.S., and c'est important, je pense, de penser que la diversification, c'est pas un abandon des États-Unis. C'est une police d'assurance, c'est un levier de négociation, et c'est aussi une source de résilience pour notre pays. As we were saying, it's not going to replace the U.S., but a deeper relationship with Europe and our other partners. I mean, obviously, I'm not forgetting Latin America and Asia in particular, can certainly reduce the cost of our over-dependence on the U.S. I mean, the trade relationship is very strong with the U.S. still, I think the last stats I saw was 72.5% of our exchanges actually are with the U.S. The second illusion I wanted to talk about, and actually we were just talking about this recently with David just a second ago, is that CETA alone can deliver the European opportunity. CETA's lowered barriers, create preferential access, most tariff reductions are in place, as well as services and other provisions, but it's not a magical piece of paper. The same can be said for the continuity agreement that we negotiated with the UK when they left after Brexit. It was a really interesting process, as Stephanie can attest, to negotiate with the UK on that score. So we all know that agreements can create openings and opportunities, but they don't create outcomes. Canadian companies will still need market intelligence, scale of production, export and other financing, distribution partners, standards expertise, management commitment, and very patient capital. When we had our preparatory call, we were saying how it's easy to just go down to the U.S. A small and medium-sized enterprises of 4, 5, 6 people who's been doing this for decades, already has the contacts, knows how to follow up the forms, and just drive down sometimes to deliver their stuff. Going across the pond, even though it's not very far and you do share some languages and some values, it's still a little bit more complicated. It needs a little bit more investment. It needs time. It needs perhaps more testing in terms of your SPS, you know, products and how you meet those standards. You have to maybe label it differently. And all of that is a lot of energy and time that the SMEs don't really have time to actually invest in. So that's something to think about. L'Europe, c'est pas non plus un marché unique. Elle constitue un ensemble complexe de marchés nationaux, régionaux, linguistiques et réglementaires. C'est pas aussi simple que l'on pense. The third illusion is that shared values automatically produce shared prosperity. That is certainly not the case. I mean, we do share commitments to democracy, the rule of law, climate action, labor standards, open markets. Shared values, though, do not eliminate commercial friction at all. Having spent some time in Europe trying to assist Canadian companies to just try their product to make sure their product would be accepted in the EU and the construction industry, was years and years and years of going through hoops, filling out forms, getting it tested, and so on. Les systèmes réglementaires européens peuvent être très exigeants. Les processus pour les marchés publics sont aussi très complexes. Les politiques industrielles deviennent plus stratégiques. Les instincts protectionnistes sont plus forts. Sans oublier que les entreprises européennes sont aussi très compétitives. We're not going in there by ourselves. That market's been integrated for decades, and the relationships that exist there exist for a reason. They've been actually really profitable for everybody involved. The opportunity in front of us, though, is not sentimental, it's strategic. And while shared values can make cooperation easier, we hope that more integrated networks and healthy competition can actually make it durable. I'll talk a little bit about the first reality, and that's that the economic relationship is actually quite substantial already. L'Europe, et plus précisément l'Union européenne, est l'une des plus grandes économies du monde, le deuxième partenaire commercial du Canada après les États-Unis. Le Royaume-Uni, l'Allemagne, le Pays-Bas, la France, l'Italie sont tous dans notre top 10 déjà. Alors, on ne va pas réinventer la roue ce côté-là, mais il faut juste aller plus profondément. In 2025, the good news is that exports to Europe and Central Asia rose sharply, increasing by $22 billion, plus 30%. And that would follow a really large increase in 2024 as well of 24%. So that's nothing to sneeze at and something that we can build upon. And as we've all known, since the provisional application in 2017, trade has really multiplied with the EU. So we need to go and do more of that. The investment ties also run deep with a really important two-way foreign investment stocks between Canada and the EU and Europe more specifically. I'll include the UK in there. Direct investment stock from Europe were up by $32 billion to $529 billion at the end of 2025. That represents 33% of all investment stock in Canada. That's enormous. And just to compare, the U.S. is 46%. So Europe's actually playing a really large role in our FDI Stalking Canada. Le Canada a aussi conclu, et ça, c'est une des trucs que je faisais lors de mon dernier travail comme directeur général sur l'innovation. On a conclu de nombreux accords sciences, technologie, innovation avec tous les grands pays européens chefs de file en termes d'innovation et aussi avec l'Union européenne elle-même. Donc, il y a beaucoup d'opportunités là qui se présentent pour aller plus profondément sur une intégration en sciences, technologies et pour justement découvrir les services et les biens de demain pour pouvoir les fabriquer ensemble. The new EU-Canada Strategic Partnership of the Future announced in June last year will, to quote the PM's press release, and I'm just reading here, build on our enduring commitment and further reinforce the strategic partnership between the European Union and Canada. And my last thing is, in terms of reality, is that Europe really does want what Canada has to offer. They're seeking secure power supply, democratic and lower risk sources of critical minerals, energy, food, clean technology, digital infrastructure, defense inputs we've talked about in our earlier panel. On a tous les avantages dans tous ces secteurs pour être un fournisseur de services et de biens très sécuritaire pour l'Union européenne et pour les pays européens. But we should not just sell our commodities to Europe, but build value chains with Europe. We should look at processing, manufacturing, common standards, promoting joint science technology, innovation, and continue to attract investment in that sector. On that, I will add that Canada also needs to do better in terms of approval of projects in here when actually European capital is looking at ways to invest in all of those types of projects here. In conclusion, Canadian prosperity requires optionality. More customers, more investors, more supply routes, more value chains, more standards partnerships, more joint innovations, and more strategic allies. And Canada can provide all of that and help us be in a stronger position in North America by reducing our vulnerability created by excessive dependence. Il n'en tient qu'à nous pour faire les efforts nécessaires pour faire de ceci une réalité. Le gouvernement peut offrir des outils aux entreprises, mais encore une fois, les entreprises devront prendre les décisions qui s'imposent et aussi faire les efforts nécessaires. Et ça m'amène à parler à Patrick. Merci.
Merci, Nathalie. Bonjour, good morning, good afternoon. Désolé de vous avoir crié dans les oreilles pour vous faire asseoir et avoir été sexiste envers Alison en me disant que je peux crier plus fort qu'elle. Elle a raison. Alors, je m'en excuse. I'd like to thank Jonathan Miller for bringing up the idea that economy and security cannot be siloed, separated. It's something that, unfortunately, too many people do, especially in academia. That's a separate session. En fait, j'allais parler d'une réalité, d'une illusion, et en écoutant mes collègues ici sur le panel, j'ai décidé de les inverser. Donc, en fait, l'illusion, si on part d'un point de vue purement économique, et c'est là où on voit le lien entre sécurité et économie, si on part d'un point de vue purement économique, la diversification dont on parle est une illusion. Diversification in this country is something we've talked about for how many decades? You know, I'm sure that even before those who have retired from global affairs, DFAT, whatever it was called, you heard that there was already talk of trade diversification or economic diversification. So in fact, from a purely economic perspective, that's the illusion. The reality from a purely economic perspective is the 51st state. You want to create prosperity in this country, economic prosperity, not social, not democratic, just purely economic. Canada should become the 51st state. We'd have lower taxes. We'd be part of a bigger economy. No uncertainty when it comes to tariffs, anything like that. Donald Trump is right. We would be better as the 51st state from a purely economic perspective. That's the reality. Now, why do we talk about trade diversification? Why do we talk about partnerships with Europe, Japan, the Indo-Pacific? Because we don't think about just our economic prosperity. We believe in security. We believe in sovereignty. We believe in Canada being its own standing country, not only for the last 250 years, and for those who have not read Madeleine Drouin's book about He Did Not Conquer, about Benjamin Franklin, please go and read that book. If it was not for what happened here in Canada, in Quebec, we would not be here, okay? So that's how we need to understand what's going on. Now, what I really want to talk with you about is the fact that a lot of the conversations we have about trade diversification, all that, is that, you know, it's going to happen. Our prime minister is going to have this great investment fest in September, and all of a sudden there's going to be $500 billion just falling from the sky to fund all these great projects that we are putting forward. Now, si je faisais un sondage dans la salle, combien de personnes pensent que au mois de le 25 septembre autour de ça, qu'il va avoir $500 billion de promis pour investir au Canada? Levez votre main. Raise your hand if you think there's going to be $500 billion. Like, not people saying, yeah, yeah, sure, sure, I'll do it. That's what they say to Trump. But, like, signatures. How many? One hand. Okay. So the reality is that we often assume that business will follow. And as Natalie said, it's hard, right? Business does not follow. They follow the path of least resistance. They want to go where the risk is minimal and where there's money to be made, right? So if we don't want to become the 51st state and just focus on economic prosperity, but we want to focus on what prosperity means in its entirety, whether it's having good healthcare, good education, a democratic, liberal, open society, diverse, if that's what we call prosperity, then we're going to have to put a lot of effort, a lot of money on the table, and that money is not all going to come from the private sector. A lot of money is going to have to come from the public sector to bail in, if you want, the private sector, where they're going to say, oh, you're giving me monetary incentives. You're removing my risk of building a new pipeline, for instance, because interestingly enough, there's no private company that wants to build a pipeline in this country. Why is that? Are they just saying, ha, we're going to tell them we're not going to build it and then the government's going to pay us to do it? But even before there was even this possibility, a lot of projects got canceled because, well, the money is not there. It's too risky. We don't know. Like, now there's a shortage in oil. Next year, they're announcing a surplus. You know, like, if you're in the business of oil, you're just sitting there like, okay, I know where my market is, but not clear that I'm going to build a new pipeline that's going to cost $35 billion. Donc, il va falloir être prêt à payer. Ça veut dire pour les entreprises, les PME, c'est pas juste de signer des accords de libre-échange qui ouvrent la porte, c'est de les accompagner main dans la main pour des années. Si on veut qu'elles puissent développer les marchés européens, japonais, coréens, thaïlandais, indiens, si vous voulez. Ensuite, ça va vouloir dire, hein, même, parce que à la fin, at the end of the day, you know, Drew talked about gravity. The pull is there. Geography, we can't ignore it. So, you know, what do we do on Earth when we want to leave this Earth's gravity? Well, we use rockets with a shitload of fuel. And that's the same logic. If we want to pull out of the U.S. orbit, we're going to need a shitload of fuel. That means human fuel, financial fuel. And we have to be ready as a society, not just as governments and business, but as a society to invest in building those rockets, not to go in outer space and, you know, with no attachment to our neighbor down to the south. But it'd be nice if we were kind of more in orbit and, you know, we could play more easily, less pulled by the U.S. But, you know, to me, the rocket is, and certainly not from Musk, please, no Musk rockets. Anyways, I'll stop here. Merci.
good start. Three quite different perspectives. Let me ask a few questions and start things off. See, it's my reminder of timing. Work. Drew, let me ask you the first question. And this goes back to the third option of beloved memory 50 years ago or over that, not outlined in the foreign policy for Canadians, although we still attribute it to that document, interestingly enough. It was a thought. It was never actually a policy, by the way. Another myth, by the way. So in the intervening period, we have at various times let integration with the U.S. just proceed without a framework. At other times, we concluded a treaty arrangement as a way we thought to guarantee access to the U.S. And we have tried to diversify our economic relations through facilitative free trade agreements with lots of other markets, only to see that nothing fundamental has changed in our exposure to the vagaries of U.S. politics. So the question is, what now? How would you envisage a new fourth option, combining an optimal level of integration with the U.S., optimal, again, referring back to Patrick's view of integration, with more independence and broader network of relationships in the world? Is this fourth option to be like some form of, dare I say it, sovereignty association?
Sovereignty association with who? Ooh, that scared me. So can I just, I want to start with Patrick's point. And fundamentally, the fourth option is the fact that we really don't have options and we're not making choices. We're doing it all and we're trying to balance domestic expansion, including infrastructure development, which in some cases we do well. The Gordie Howe Bridge was done extremely well in terms of money. We just can't get the thing open. With expansion to the rest of the world, with defense right now, with regard to the United States. The idea that we actually had free trade with the United States is a bit of a misnomer. It wasn't a European-style relationship by any means, and I don't bring the politics into it, which is sensitive, interestingly, on both sides of the border. But the tariffs that we eliminated, as you know, were not equal to the equivalent tariffs with regard to regulatory differences. If you had perfect free trade, our trade with the United States in true economic terms, kind of Patrick aimed at that, would be much more than 75% and a much bigger portion of our GDP. It's Paul Krugman, an American, who said, you know, Canadians, if you look at the population, live closer than Americans than they do to themselves. All the major Canadian cities are closer than American cities than they are to Canadian cities, exception of Edmonton and Calgary. And I'll make a final point with regard to, just for fun, Patrick's 51st state. So the problem is really that he hasn't, Trump hasn't offered us 21 state status. The complete dysfunction of the American system, to my mind, is the nice example is the 21 smallest states, 42 seats in the Senate, are the size of California, and also, by the way, the size of Canada. So if we want to make a counteroffer, and I'm not suggesting we do, Carney can offer 21. And if Trump was serious, he'd meet us at 15. But, you know, we have a population of 42 million, and the smallest 21 states have a population of 39, coincidentally the same size as California. So Trump's offering us the California model. We'll counter with the other model. That's the dysfunction. And any study, political science study of the United States, will point something like that out. And the inability to fix it, which is permanent from the looks of it, the numbers are actually going to get worse in the future. Because look, where's the population growth? You know, 1970, and by the way, there were six chapters in the 1970 report and not one on the United States, right? So politics trumped economics in an era, you know, before the rise of the market in the late 1970s. So this could be done, the pivot, to Europe, and primarily we thought Europe, we associated with Europe given the times, out of Ottawa, primarily, fundamentally. And then, of course, there was a trend in the late 70s with Thatcher and Reagan toward more open markets, greater trade, also reduced taxes, and greater income inequality towards open markets. And Mulroney took the step. And now we're moving back to an era in which, and again, like Jonathan noted, everything's connected. Security, you were talking about security being connected. Security is connected to trade, so it's connection horizontal, and always have trouble getting that right, and vertically with regard to trade and security. So we're not going to, the fourth option, we're not going to make a choice. We're going to play defense with the United States, and I think as difficult as it is, the team is actually doing pretty well, and there will be deeper integration in some circumstances, less integration in others, deeper on critical minerals, possibly less on autos. What do we care about more? Critical minerals is our hogs and logs now. Autos is a dying sector in North America. Focus on the future. Can't say that to Doug Ford, but it's actually true. And in addition, looking to other sectors as well, which, as Natalie pointed out, we're actually doing quite well with regard to Europe and with Asia. Thanks.
For me, I guess. Natalie, you spoke eloquently about the EU. And the question that arises in my mind is how deep can that relationship with the EU ever be, given the loss of faith in Europe in Atlanticism and our own focus on keeping the US from exploiting our proximity? So that would be the first part of my question. How deep can it go? Indeed, can it go any deeper than it is now, despite the papers that we have signed with us? And the second question, I guess, which is more generally the same question, are there governments interested enough in an economic partnership with Canada to resist what can be expected for sure to be a U.S. insistence on Fortress North America? What can we offer to make ourselves irresistible to foreign markets despite America wanting us to stay intensely within their orbit?
Thanks, George. I think I covered a little bit of that during my first remarks, but I will say it's important to try and get the relationship to be a bit deeper. And by that, I mean not only in terms of trade, in terms of values, but also in terms of doing things together. So Europe is very much looking to Canada as being a partner across the Atlantic, that they can trust, that they feel comfortable with, and whether it is about building Coast Guard ships in Finland, or it is about, you know, accessing critical minerals here, we have things on offer that we can do jointly with EU countries. I think that would stand us in good stead to create this very solid alliance to meet future challenges that can insulate not only ourselves, but them as well from perhaps over-dependence on the US or the U.S. being a bit of a bully when they don't get exactly what they want. It is also true as well that that could also do a counterbalance to perhaps China and China's influence in certain areas of the world. And we have quite a few countries in Europe, in the EU, where we have privileged relationships. I can talk about the U.K. and France and Italy, where I was posted. But Germany also, in terms of its industrial base, needing secure supplies of critical minerals, they are extremely advanced economically and a good partner for us and us a good partner for them. We've always moved deeper already with the UK and with Germany on the critical minerals file. And we certainly hope at some point in time to create manufacturing, processing, new ways to process. As you probably all know, we are overly dependent on China for critical minerals processing. They seem to own all of the know-how as well. And it's only by working with these very advanced STI-led economies like Germany, France, the UK, and Europe, that we will be able to try and find a way to flip that switch at some point and not only be able to access the critical minerals in Canada, but also take them out of the ground and process them here so that we can become a partner for the rest of the world that can be trusted and that will not shut off supply whenever somebody gets upset about X, Y, or Z. It's about scaling up what we already do and making it even deeper in terms of integration. I'll also say that we are already doing a lot on STI collaboration in Europe. The Netherlands, for instance, that's one of the last things I signed as DG, is a cooperation agreement on doing more with them. And looking at how the US has acted in the last year and a half on the science side of things, where essentially they've cut funding to universities, to think tanks, to laboratories, they've cut funding mechanisms altogether. Canada is a partner with Horizon Europe and has access to all these types of funding and these collaborative mechanisms for and to ensure that we are now the big player. We should also be a little bit more proactive, perhaps, in like attracting scientists from the U.S. into Canada, whether they are actually U.S. citizens or other citizens that have been practicing their great science-based innovations in the U.S., but now feel that, one, they don't have enough financing, and two, sometimes perhaps are limited in what they can concentrate on. So I think I will leave it at that for now. Thanks.
Those thoughts. Patrick, boy, we're really keeping our schedule. I know. How about that? Patrick, you pointed out a very powerful point that the private sector has based its strategies on proximity and compatibility with the United States over the years, despite a whole bunch of FTAs with other markets. Now, I think we all understand that business reacts to opportunity and threats like any biological entity. So the question to me is, what and where are those evident opportunities for Canadian business outside of the United States that would actually help implement the Prime Minister's agenda of diversification? On the one hand, for opportunities, and do the vagaries of U.S. trade policy present enough of a threat to stimulate Canadian business to look beyond the U.S. for their bread and butter? And I'll end on a pessimistic question. Is it possible that neither of these is going to change the gravitational pull of proximity for Canadian business? Will they calculate that it's worth swallowing whatever tariffs, restrictions, random policies that the U.S. imposes in order to keep access to the U.S. market and even actually moving south to maximize proximity? We've seen instances of that, not many, but is that a possibility that Canadian business will, in a significant degree, decide to become their own 51st state, if you like? So the real question here is, how do we keep them at home, but acting globally? Thoughts on that?
I was going to answer your questions like, yes, yes, yes. Avant de... So if anyone thought that I'm actually advocating for the 51st state, I just want to make that clear that I am not. I'm just saying that, you know, if we don't want it, then we really have to, let's say, be ready to put a lot more energy into leaving that, or at least minimizing the gravitational pull. So in answer to George's question, so before I talk about, you know, which sectors or whatever, first of all, the sectors where to go to diversify beyond the U.S. or go into the U.S. to me makes no difference. You know, like ultimately, you know, if we're competitive in Europe, in the Indo-Pacific, well, that probably means we're competitive in the U.S. And I think if it makes sense for Canadian businesses to do business in the U.S., we should certainly not prevent them from doing that. And that's where we come into this. Okay, how do we make that? How do we make help or incentivize Canadian businesses from going beyond the U.S. And also, no, let's not forget, attracting also investors who want to invest in Canada for Canada. Obviously, in the past, the narrative was come to Canada to go to the U.S., right? That was the logic. That's how we sold ourselves. And hey, we have all these free trade agreements, you know, with all the G7 countries. And well, don't invest in the U.S. Come to us, and then you have, you know, easy access to North America, and you have these free trade agreements with each other. Although they were never connected per se, you know, in terms of rules of origin. But I won't get into that. So I think, again, if some, you know, the access to the U.S., you know, a lot of companies will pay the 5, 10, 15% tariff to go to the U.S. in some cases, because that's still going to be cheaper than trying to penetrate the Japanese market, the French market, the German market, the South Korean market, you know, even the Chinese market, because 10, 15, 20% might still be worth it, right? Others that, you know, that have the means will just say, hey, you know, I'm going to set up a business in the U.S. to do business for the U.S. And that's going to be it. Doesn't mean that then they're not going to do business in Canada. They can't do business in other parts of the world. So ultimately, it's one thing is how do we make our economy attractive for Canadian businesses to invest here? How do we make it attractive for foreign companies to come and invest in Canada for Canada, not for the United States? Really? And how do we also can think of ourselves as a place where you can also export from, right? And that's, in a way, that's where the current government is trying to go, although the messages sometimes is a bit mixed. As I said, thinking that private capital is just going to buy this. So my kind of joke is that Mark Carney is governing when it comes to this a bit like a central banker. You ultimately want to not do anything but send enough signals that the market will just react, you know, and you don't have to start doing quantitative easing and all these things. Remember the story about Mario Draghi, who saved the euro crisis with this great program? I used to do European stuff, right? And he said that the program that he put in place that ultimately solved the crisis, because the markets thought that, ooh, we're good. You know, the European Central Bank is behind this, and they're just going to, you know, if something breaks down, they have enough firepower to solve it. Oh, I guess I'm up. And then it worked. So he just said, we'll do whatever it takes. And then the market said, oh, great. It was credible. And then he said it was the best program ever. We never had to use it. And I think this is kind of Mark Carney's approach to say, like, we're sending all the right signals, and hopefully that's going to be enough to convince private investors from all around the world, including in Canada, to invest here. I hope it works, but I'd like to have a plan B just in case it doesn't. So I guess I'll leave it at that. And I didn't really answer your questions about which markets, but, you know, I think I that can be another question that I answer later.
So a couple things. One, I think the terms of trade that we have right now, maybe a little bit less in the last couple of days, do point to something that I forget which leader said. You know, there is some degree of the world, you know, needs at least some of what Canada has. Remember the time in 2022, which the German chancellor at the time came to Ottawa on critical minerals, and we sent him away, actually on LNG and critical minerals. LNG in particular. Really?
We have the LNG that you need.
And then they turned down the German chancellor, right? That's changed. That's completely changed, right? And with some concern with regard to environmental protections, reasonably. The other thing I'd say with regard to the United States is if you go back to those who were around for the free trade negotiations in the 80s, because market conditions, the dominance of markets over politics was so great or building, we didn't really consider the possibility that the word dependence, which a lot of people didn't like as a word, and now is relevant, would actually be weaponized. And Trump has weaponized it. You know, when he talks about the auto sector, which we always thought of and previous U.S. administrations thought of as the penultimate integrated sector, even if the big three were all headquartered in Detroit, it wasn't weaponized to the extent that politics would be used openly behind the scenes to tilt the playing field. And that's what he's done. He talks about runaway production. We've produced cars with the United States since cars started being produced. Pretty close. Right now, maybe a declining sector, which I think it is in North America. And thank God, one good thing about Trump is he's always focused on declining sectors, right? I mean, you know, there's coal, he's fixated on supply management. Yeah, man, get rid of it, you know, like go for it. And Carney will probably give up some room, right? He will give up some room. It'll cost taxpayers $3 to $4 billion, like happened in Kuzma 1. But, you know, ultimately it'd be good for the economy. But he's always focused on the declining sectors. But he's weaponized things that we never thought would be weaponized because we thought we'd have a North American rule of law, even if the integration wasn't full. And we knew back then that the Chapter 19, the dispute settlement mechanism was not perfect. But it was more than the United States had ever given anybody before, not even close. And it was controversial down there to go that far, right? And now, look what it's worth, because it was just steamrolled. So we got to be conscious with regard to that, right?
Okay. Thank you, all three of you, for this little discussion here. I don't know how much time we have for questions. We're running fairly late. No, we're okay? How many?
The next panel starts at 3:45. So we just have to include time for transition. Okay. No break. Yeah.
All right, we'll go as far as we can. You have the mic.
Thank you very much to all the panelists for the insightful and spirited conversation. I especially enjoyed the space-related references. I'm a recent graduate of the University of Ottawa Faculty of Law. And before that, in my past life, if I'm allowed to say that in this room, I worked as a trade commissioner in Tanzania. So while you spoke about many regions of the world, I heard no mention of Africa. And you're, of course, aware that Canada has, for the first time ever, its first African strategy, 2025, that talks about economic cooperation, defense cooperation, climate change, security. I'm curious to know if that strategy is in itself an illusion. I hope not. And what you think the role of cooperation with Africa is in building Canadian prosperity.
Hello. I'm going to take that one. I don't think it's an illusion. I do think that Africa is the continent of the future. Just look at the demographics of that continent. Do I think it's an easy thing to do? The answer is no. It's always more complex than we think. I will speak a little bit about my own experience, which was in Morocco and Mauritania. So there was a lot of trade and with Morocco and in Canada, well, a lot, not a lot compared to the US or the EU, but quite a bit, including our durum wheat exports. Lo and behold, the couscous made in Morocco, the good one anyway, is made with Canadian wheat. But that relationship, we wanted to take further. I spent 3 years trying to negotiate a free trade agreement with the Moroccans to go nowhere. Absolutely nowhere, unfortunately. So there would have been room to do more. I think that the way to look at Africa is very much from a bloc perspective. Africa's huge. You need to choose and pick carefully. And there are already existing, I'm going to call them markets in Africa where you can dig deeper. But it's certainly going to need a lot of investment, a lot of knowledge, a lot of making sure the playing field is leveled. And on the investment side in particular, because that's where we're the most present in terms of mining in particular. And governments are, regularly just sort of sending our companies out of the country and like nationalizing our assets, and ensuring that there are FIPAs, foreign investment protection agreements, for those who don't know, in place that are very solid and respected is a key way to ensure that the trade continues after, like, basically trade follows investments a lot of the time. And so if we can sort that out to everybody's satisfaction, I think there's more of a chance of it succeeding than not. But I do think it's a long-term goal and not tomorrow morning goal.
Thank you, Natalie. I think those comments probably apply more widely than just Africa.
Oui, bonjour. Bon, elle m'a volé un peu ma question parce que c'était aussi sur l'Afrique où j'étais au Congo tout récemment. Vous avez parlé tout à l'heure d'ailleurs de la question des minéraux critiques et puis que c'était la Chine où il y avait la plus grande capacité de traitement. Mais s'ils ont la plus grande capacité de traitement, c'est parce qu'ils ont justement accès à ces ressources-là. Et si on n'agit pas maintenant, ben, je pense qu'on perd aussi une opportunité. Ça fait quoi, depuis une heure et demie, depuis une heure qu'on parle, c'est la première fois là, donc qu'on parle d'Afrique. C'est important de s'ouvrir. On avait une stratégie des Amériques aussi, il n'y a pas si longtemps que ça, là, pour ceux qui s'en souviennent. J'aimerais aussi vous entendre parler des Amériques et voir comment tout ça se positionne. Merci.
I think we could probably have a whole day on the regional issues. There are so many opportunities and so many different ones. But since we only have 2 minutes, perhaps we can reserve that for a separate conversation. Thank you. Are there other questions? Yeah, well, go ahead.
Yeah, I have one. My name is Daryl Copeland. It seems to me security and prosperity are pretty much inevitably the ends of international policy. And in any sort of international policy envelope, you've got diplomacy, you've got defense, you've got development spending. And it seems to me that there's a dialectical relationship between results and resources. And at the moment, our distribution of those resources seems to me to be terribly imbalanced in such a way that it's going to be impossible to achieve the Prime Minister's objectives having to do with variable geometry and values-based realism and banding together of middle powers to stand up the global hegemons. And the reason that I say this is this massive redirection of international policy resources into defense at the expense of diplomacy and development strikes me as very, very seriously undermining the prospects of achieving the goals that the Prime Minister has set out. I don't think he's got the horses. I don't think we've got the policy heft to deliver on this stuff. And, you know, you can't call in an airstrike on a warming climate. You can't send out an expeditionary force to occupy the alternatives to a carbon economy. So what are you going to do? Okay.
Thanks, Daryl.
Point two, the other unspoken thing in the room is power shift, Anglosphere to Sinosphere. Are we ready for this? Because by anything that you can measure, it's happening, and I haven't heard a word about it today.
Mm-hmm. Well, yet again, a subject for a whole day, I would think. But Michael also had a question. And I think this will be the last one. He has the privilege as president.
My question is simple and direct for each of the panelists. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about Canada's chances of playing defense at home, to use Drew's words, and offense abroad over, let's say, the next 5 years?
You're not talking about FIFA, Ersin.
Ouais, c'est moi qui dois répondre à la question. Il y a beaucoup de questions, il y a beaucoup d'enjeux. Rapidement, sur la question de l'optimisme, oui, je suis optimiste. On n'a pas le choix. Comme, sinon, c'est le 51e état. That's it. It's like, donc, c'est à nous tous de s'assurer que, un, il faut être optimiste et prendre les moyens de maintenir cet optimisme. You know, and in terms of Africa, Latin America, the diplomatic core, yes, yes, yes. I mean, it's true that we want to be out there in the world. Yes, it's not like we're no longer in a world, and I'm sorry to say this, but we're no longer in a world of either or. We do defense or we do diplomacy. We have to do everything. Stephanie talked about a whole of society approach. We have no choice. It is ultimately, I believe, the survival of this country in the long run. I you know, and you call me crazy. Thanks, I'm an academic, so I can say crazy stuff. But this is what I fundamentally believe, because the U.S. is not going to change anytime soon. China is not going to change anytime soon. Russia is not going to change anytime soon. And there are other countries who are going to play this kind of powerful game. We are still, you know, whatever, 10th, 11th largest economy in the world. That counts for something, but we're not big enough, first of all, to survive these big guys alone, but we certainly can do a lot, and we can partner with those countries who share the same kind of values and view of the world that we care about, and that's what we have to do, and that's why, and I think we can do it. It's just that, you know, we kind of accepted this sort of nice, easygoing reality for the last 25, 30 years, you know, the end of history. That's the world we want. Except that that's not the world we have, and that's not the world we've had, except we've tried to keep it going. So, and that means, you know, Africa is an important, I don't think that right now the government at the higher echelons, let's say, cares a lot about Africa. They don't talk about Africa. Carney is not going to Africa, but I think it matters. You're right. It's, you know, a big continent doesn't mean that we have to deal with every country there. Maybe there are partner countries that we can use to do business with, and then from there go somewhere else. Same for Latin America. But ultimately, I think overall, my view is on doit être partout et on doit être prêt à investir, même si ça va coûter beaucoup d'argent pour le gouvernement, pour les contribuables. Mais encore là, il faut expliquer à la population qu'est-ce qu'on fait et pourquoi on le fait à long terme. Mais si on pense qu'on va être capable de le faire sans que ça coûte rien, tu sais, M. Carney a parlé de sacrifice, mais jusqu'à maintenant, il n'en a pas demandé. Hein, il espère qu'il n'aura pas besoin de le demander pour des raisons politiques, ça va. Mais sinon, c'est vrai qu'il va avoir des sacrifices à faire. Parce que si on veut avoir le pays qu'on veut avoir, ben ça, il faut être prêt à payer pour. Et ça prend le capital humain et le capital physique et le capital financier.
Thank you, Patrick. I would then put you as pessimistically optimistic.
Not to us.
Yeah. Natalie, in a word.
In a word, I'm optimistic because I've seen what we can do when we work together to meet challenges. And I'll leave it at that because I have a second and a half to answer. Drew, you have a second and a half too?
Yeah. You know, this crisis, if that's what it is, gone on for 18 months. Right. I'm getting more optimistic, but at the same time, while some people, some of the rhetoric and some of the writing makes it seem we're in the Battle of Britain. We're not in the Battle of Britain, you know, it's the Blitz, but I'm not sure the country has changed adequately to the challenge. Right. There's a lot of the same old politics, internecine, is that the word, you know, backbiting, you know, I'm not convinced, but I'm getting more up.
Maybe more 51st state stuff from President Trump will help. 71st. We do owe President Trump a whole new sense of national identity, by the way. This conversation would make me positive in terms of a country that sticks together and works together. Thank you very much.